introduce at this time William Mark for his second lecture.
Just one little thing about our singing at Mass in the next 3 days, and that is when we alternate, that will be, for instance, the Te Deum at the Holy Hour and the sequence at the Requiem Mass, and whenever else we're singing in alternation, men and women, we want to pay attention to how the alternation works. That is to say, no break between the two sides. So, just go right on and make no break. This morning there were some breaks and it wasn't quite clear just when to start. So, think about keeping the rhythm flowing by picking up the rhythm from the other side as you sing. I spoke last night about Pius X's criteria of sacred music. Sacred, beautiful, and universal. And what I want to do tonight is to focus upon sacred. Partly because it's a burning question in our own time. You look at documents from the Middle Ages and you find rather little discussion of what is sacred. In fact, they didn't have to discuss it. They took it for granted. On the other hand, Anthony Ruskell says, the word sacred wasn't used until the 19th or 20th century, so it's an irrelevant criterion. Rather, it was taken for granted. And it is a very relevant criteria because it's no longer taken for granted. And so that's something that we want to think about, because of course you'll realize we've been dedicated to the notion of sacred music. That's the title of our journal, and that's the title of in the chapter in Sacrosanctum Concilium. So the notion of the sacred is certainly embodied in the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy. So, what I want to do is, in fact, to talk about the context of things sacred. That is to say, sacred space and sacred time, as they may relate to music. First of all, a definition. I make a distinction between the term sacred place and sacred space. In the Middle Ages, there was a right place for a church. There were holy places in each vicinity, and that's where you built a church. The Cathedral of Chartres was built on the location of a well where there had been miracles. And so when you built a new church, you generally built it on the site of an old church. All of the Gothic cathedrals of England, with one exception, were built on the foundations of an old Romanesque cathedral. The one exception is Salzburg. We'll talk about that a little bit. Fact is, Salisbury was, the Cathedral of Salisbury was built within the walls of an old fort, up on a hill. This was William the Conqueror's solution. He had his cathedral and his bishop right under the nose of the military. In the 13th century, the cathedral staff wanted to get out of the fort because they felt repressed by the limitations that the military imposed upon them. And so they did choose a new site outside the realm of the old fort. This was not a time immemorial change, however, because the placement of the cathedral within the walls of the fort was within memory. It was a matter of a century and a half or so, so that isn't very long in terms of how cathedrals go. So they built a new site. They found land down on the plain below the old hill, and in fact there is a legend about the placement of that site which is very interesting. The legend is someone shot an arrow from the site of the old cathedral on top of the hill. It hit a deer. The deer ran and died on the spot of the new cathedral. You see, one in the 20th, 21st century, one smiles at such legends because our inclination is to believe that this is just made up. But the fact is, even if it's made up, what it tells you is important. There had to be a link between the sacred place of the old and the new churches. And it turns out, you look at the discussions of sacred place, and you find that in primitive societies, the way to identify a sacred place is to shoot an animal as a sacrifice, and then to make the sacred building on that site. And one finds in Scandinavia similar legends of the sacrificing of animals as a place to as a way to establish a sacred place. So the legend, whether it's very doubtful probably, but whether someone shot a deer and it died or not, the fact that you have the story that they did tells you that they valued the link between the old place and the new place. So I'm saying then that sacred place is an important concept, and you have even within a church building sacred places. The altar is the most sacred place within a church building. Then the term sacred space is the relationships of sacred places. The relationship of the altar to the nave is a question of sacred space. And I'm going to talk a little bit about sacred space particularly. The anthropologists, when they talk about sacred space, talk about the opposition between sacred and profane. And by profane, they mean not blasphemous, but rather secular. So profanum, the etymology of profane, means outside the temple. When you examine the evidence from the Middle Ages, there is not so much an opposition between sacred and profane as there is a hierarchy of sacred spaces. So you look at the Salisbury Cathedral, for instance, and you find the altar is the sacred place, but then you find degrees of sacredness throughout the building. And you have, in fact, on your handout a diagram of Salisbury Cathedral floor plan. And you can look at that, and I'll show you some things that illustrate the sacred space there. Now, there are several elements of sacred space that we can see in these in this diagram. First of all, in England particularly, and in the Middle Ages in general, churches were always oriented. They faced east. And the farther toward the east you got, the closer to the most sacred place you got. It's an interesting thing if you look at villages that or towns that have more than one church in England. It looks as if someone had taken a magnet and caused them all to face in the same direction, because they all face east. And if you happen to run into a church that doesn't face east, particularly faces north, then you know that it's a nonconformist church. It's probably a Methodist church, because they intentionally built churches that did not face east to differentiate themselves from that old Anglican church. So the church then faced east, and east was the symbol. First of all, the rising sun, which was in turn a symbol of Christ, and east was the location that was traditionally said to be the direction where Christ ascended and the direction from which he would return again. So the east had important symbols. Burials were made so that the buried, when the second coming came, could stand up and face east. So the feet were always towards the east and the head towards the west. I was astonished to discover that in my little hometown, the cemetery still has all of the burials facing east. And I asked the funeral director in the town, is this a custom? He said, oh yes, we always bury facing east. And I said, why? He said, that's just how you do it. And I told him about orientation, and he was astonished. So there you have a perpetuating tradition that goes all the way back to this tradition of orientation. Now, within the cathedral itself, the easternmost part is emphasized by several things. One of them is that there are progressive steps upwards as you go east. There is a step as you go into the choir screen. There is a step from the choir into the presbytery. There is a step at the presbytery. If the church happens, and this one doesn't, but if the church happens, as Canterbury Cathedral happens to have a crypt, that is a lower level sort of chapel beneath the high altar. Generally speaking, there are a number of steps then. The high altar is raised so the crypt doesn't have to be excavated too deeply. And at Canterbury, you have 15 steps going up to the choir screen. And then you have something like 7 going up to the altar. And then 3 or 4 more behind the altar. And then even some more up into the easternmost shrine. So there is, and if you ever get to Canterbury, make a point of walking from the west portal all the way through to the east end and see this wonderful sense of elevation that takes place as you move from the west to the east. So then there is another point, and that is, if you look on this diagram, number 1 is the Lady Chapel. To the east of the high altar is the easternmost chapel, which is the point at which the Lady Mass was sung in secular cathedrals. In monastic cathedrals, Lady Chapels were often at different places because from the choir screen eastward was monastic enclosure, and the laity were not permitted to enter into that part of the building. Rather, at some place like Ely, the Lady Chapel is off to the left from off the north transept, or at some place like Glastonbury or Durham, it's at the west end And this is because Lady Chapel was regularly visited by the laity, and the Lady Mass was attended by the laity. But all of this then suggests that there's quite a difference between orientation and, that is, orientation facing east, and the celebration of the liturgy facing east, as you'll see in some of our messages yet this week, and a centering upon the congregation and the priest who faces the congregation. And this suggests an analogy, at least, between, on the one hand, a theocentric orientation of the liturgy, that is to say, a notion that the liturgy essentially addresses God, or an anthropocentric orientation, a notion that the liturgy, in fact, focuses more upon the congregation. And all of this has ramifications for what music you sing. Likewise, there is a difference between considering a transcendent object of the liturgy and an inner. So these will come into consideration as we think about what the object and the orientation of the liturgy is. Pope Benedict has talked about this, and he has reminded us that in the early Christian churches, the apse, that is to say, the rounded eastern end of the church, would generally have a very large image of Christ. And one of the aspects of orientation, that is facing east, was in fact facing the image of Christ. And so he has proposed a kind of an intermediate solution to the problem of facing people. That in fact, if you have an altar facing the people, then you might place a crucifix there, and that would be a replacement for the facing of the image of Christ in the apse. You now face it at the altar. And what, if you see, you can always see on EWTN television many of the masses that are celebrated by Pope Benedict. When you see him celebrating the Mass, what you see is a crucifix on the altar. And not only that, but he is looking intently at that crucifix the whole time that he is celebrating the Mass. And so there is a focus upon the transcendent object even there. And you see, this then makes a solution to the question of, should the priest engage the crowd? Should he animate the congregation by his personal liturgical style? And I would suggest that there is a transcendent object that replaces that notion. Even the question of the location of the tabernacle is implied here. If the tabernacle is at the eastern end of the sanctuary and at the center, then it is also a focal point. A local church where I live has had a new pastor come in. I dropped into this church the other day, and what do you know? The tabernacle is gone from the altar, and it's over to the side. I suggest that there is a principle in the construction of the church that is, that values symmetry. Everything in a church building is made symmetrical, and whenever you have symmetries like that, they create a focus upon the center, and the tabernacle is at that central focus. If, in fact, on the other hand, you have on the altar, say, six candles, but all six are on one side, and you have a bouquet of flowers on the other side, you've created an asymmetry. And this is, in some sense, disruptive of the geometry and of the focal point in the church. So that symmetry is an important element. And there is then in the church an axis, that is, upon the center, that moves from the west portal, the very back of the church, the west door, all the way through the center of the church, and to the eastern end, and outside the church to a transcendent direction, a transcendent dimension. And the interesting thing about the Christian orientation is that it is distinct from both the Jewish and the Muslim orientations, which are upon geographical points, Jerusalem or Mecca. The Christian one is upon a transcendent direction, which in fact then focuses outside the entire earth, but beyond it. Now, there's another aspect of the geography of a church building, and that is the distinction between the gospel side and the epistle side. The right-hand side of the celebrant as he faces the congregation is the side of preference, just as at a banquet. The host sits at the head of the table, and the guest of honor sits to his right. And this relates to the Middle Eastern custom of, in fact, there being a clean hand and an unclean hand. If you look at the garments that are worn in the Middle East and in classical times, you'll see that the right hand is free, but the left hand is covered by the garment. Because that's the hand with which you throw things away. I discovered, without really having ever thought about this, that in whatever office I sat, I always had the wastebasket on the left-hand side. That's the side you throw things away. I think that's just a natural tendency to use the non-dominant hand to throw things away, but then the dominant hand is the side that establishes the side of priority, and the gospel side then is that. By tradition, there was always a separate emblem for the gospel on the one hand and the epistle on the other hand. And in the documents after the Second Vatican Council, the first documents say, the ambo or the ambos in the plural. So it acknowledges the fact that there could be that. What has developed is the need to co-opt the ambo on the epistle side for the use of a commentator or a cantor. So you have probably seen, I'm sure, a cantor standing at the epistle side ambo doing this. And the problem is, what does that mean? The fact is, it's too close a gesture to this. The fact is, I think it's more important to distinguish the epistle and the gospel sides. And if there's a need for the cantor to stand in front of the congregation, the cantor can stand somewhere else. If there's a gospel, an epistle, ambo here, the cantor can stand here, or here, or even here, or here. The fact is, you don't always need a cantor. You don't always need to cue the congregation into where they have to sing if they already know it. And the fact is, you see, the structure of the liturgy of the word implies a priority of the gospel. And so the gospel procession needs to go to the ambo from which you read the gospel. And in my own church, we had been reading the lessons all from the same ambo, and we've been told by the liturgists, well, the unity of the scripture is represented by using the same ambo. But the fact is, the structure of the liturgy of the word creates a progression from Old Testament to New Testament to Gospel. And there is a procession to the Gospel. And so I thought we should really probably reinstate using the Epistle site for the previous lessons. And I asked one of the priest celebrants who came just once a month, would that be agreeable to you? And he said, well, it's always occurred to me that we shouldn't be making a procession to some place where we've just been, so that the gospel location then is a privileged location. There are other solutions. Sometimes one sees the gospel side ambo being used for the other lessons, and then the gospel itself is procession is made into somewhere down to the middle of the nave, and the gospel read from there. That's another solution to the same problem. But it seems to me that the gospel side, in any case, should retain a sense of priority. And it does at Salisbury. If you look at the diagram of Salisbury Cathedral, you see that the altars on either side of the Lady Chapel, the easternmost chapel, are the one on the gospel side dedicated to St. Peter and the Apostles, and the other side to St. Stephen, and by implication, to martyrs. So that the priority of the Apostles is clear on the gospel side. Likewise, in the main transept down in front of the choir screen, there is the altar to St. John the Baptist and to St. Edmund and St. Thomas of Canterbury, both saints who received great veneration both at Canterbury and at Salisbury. And so the altars that are immediately accessible to the laity are also then on the gospel side, and it was the altar of St. John the Baptist which contained all the relics for Salisbury Cathedral. So there is then a significance to the gospel side, and it seems to me that that's something that we should think about in our celebration of the liturgies. That side also, by the way, is the traditional place of the bishop's throne. He takes a priority. It was, in fact, an argument between the papal and the imperial courts as to where the emperor should sit when there was the pope and the emperor at the same event. And the solution was the pope sat on the gospel side and the emperor had to take the epistle side. Likewise, in Germany, the location of orders very often represents the priority of the epistle side of the gospel side in alternation. The organ always took the first place in alternation when you alternated the organ with the choir. And organs are largely on the gospel side in German churches. Now, another aspect of the sacred space is that these spaces are marked by boundaries. The boundary, first of all, around the altar and the choir is the choir screen. That marks off this most sacred place where the high services take place. Around that is an aisle, which also serves as a boundary. And then the wall of the church itself is marked by 12 consecration crosses, crosses with candles below them. You can see them in any consecrated church that retains its traditional setup. So those consecration crosses then mark the boundary of the wall as a sacred space. But then there is another sacred space around the church, and that is the churchyard, consecrated ground where there were burials. And around that is a small, is a low wall that denotes the edge of the churchyard. And around that are the residences of the canons of the cathedrals and the bishop, in fact. And around that is a high wall, which is called the close, that is to say, the enclosure of the entire cathedral grounds. So there is a concentric set of boundaries. Likewise, these boundaries are articulated by portals, entrances. So the entrance to the choir screen, for instance, is that door at the western end of the choir screen, over which there is the cross with the image, with the crucifix and the image of Mary and St. John below it. Likewise, the west door of the church itself is a significant portal. It is only opened for major feast days when there is a procession that enters that west portal. And that procession then passes the font, which is placed near the west door as a symbol of baptism being the entry point into the life of the church. Very often fonts get stuck off to the side somewhere, but at Salisbury they have made a great effort to reinstate the location of that font near the door. Now, these sacred spaces are commemorated particularly by processions. So a procession generally will either encircle a sacred place or a sacred space, or they will go to a sacred place as an object. In most cases, they will do both. And so, if you turn over your handout, and turn it, give it a right turn there, you can see in figure one the route of the procession before Mass on Sunday. The procession starts from the choir, goes out the north choir door, and encircles the altar, goes up the south aisle, and then goes into the nave, around the font, and then to the choir screen before the cross, where there is what's called the station. They stop and say prayers at the station. This is the place where, in the later Middle Ages, they said bidding prayers in the vernacular, then into the choir for the beginning of the liturgy. But on major feasts, double feasts, which occurred on Sundays and on Christmas, in fact, the procession went out the west choir door and encircled the entire choir, and then went around and came up. Except on Christmas, when in fact they took a detour and went through the cloister, and then went finally around the cloister and into the church at the west end. Christmas being one of the major feast days, it might otherwise have been a day in which you would go around the outside of the church. But if you've ever lived in England in the winter, you can see why they just settled for going around the cloister. But Easter, Ascension, Pentecost, and Corpus Christi, you see in figure 3, they went out the west door and encircled the entire church, went in to the cloister, encircled the cloister, back out, and into the west door, and then up into the choir. But the most impressive procession was on Palm Sunday. And there's a long story about the history of the Palm Sunday procession that goes back to Normandy and through Canterbury Cathedral and through the old ceremony fort, which caused the shape of this procession to be placed around the walls of the church. But the basic route then, as you can see, it starts from the choir, goes out the west door of the choir, turns left, and goes around the cloister, and then out the west cloister door, and around the whole cathedral, stopping at certain points for a station and for rather significant liturgical occasions, particularly this first station at the north transept, where a second procession meets the first procession. That second procession is carrying in a reliquary all of the relics of the church and the Blessed Sacrament. And so the text of the Palm Sunday Antiphon that said, "The children of the Hebrews went out to meet the Lord," is represented very literally by meeting the Lord in the Blessed Sacrament and escorting him then around the church and into the cloister, and going then around and out so that they can make a formal entry into the west portal of the church. The relics and the Blessed Sacrament are held up above the west portal as everyone enters in beneath them. And this entry beneath the Red Blessed Sacrament and the relics then constitutes a kind of transformation, an entry, as it were, into heaven, because the church itself represents heaven. Now, is that or is that not a sacred space? There you have then a medieval example of the use of processions to commemorate sacred spaces. Likewise, at vespers, the vespers of each feast to a saint who has an altar at Salzburg Cathedral. The first vespers, that is, the vespers the evening before, at the end of the vespers, a procession is made to that saint's altar. So there is again a kind of calendric link of the geography with the calendar, so that the saint's day itself is commemorated architecturally, and that again is another kind of sacred use of sacred space. Now the question then that would come up is, are there things that we can do today that might, in fact, make use of this same sense of sacred space? The obvious one is celebration of the Mass ad orientem, again, facing east. The newspapers will tell you, oh, this is just the priest turning his back on the congregation. But in fact, it's the priest facing the same direction that the congregation faced, and that is not facing the wall, but facing God. So that the whole notion of ad orientem celebration is really one facing a transcendent direction. But there is the alternative, and that is what's now called the Benedictine order, that is to say, the use of the crucifix on the altar, as Pope Benedict has suggested. And several people have mentioned to me that Father Key's celebration of Mass the other day was a very good exemplification of that. And I think that we learn something by observing that, as one can learn by observing Pope Benedict himself celebrating, when you can watch it on EWTN. Another thing is the location of the tabernacle. If the tabernacle is located at a central location, at a symmetrical location, then it becomes a focal point. If it's off to the side, there's no focal point. Another is to simply initiate the use of singing the epistle from the epistle side and the gospel from the gospel side, making a gospel procession to the ambo for the gospel, and there is a differentiation of sacred spaces that is purposeful and useful. Another is that to recognize that the altar rail was not just there so you could kneel down for communion. It was also a boundary of the sacred space. And even if you now give communion standing up, you ought to keep the altar rail if it's there in the church, because it delineates the sacred space. Likewise, that sacred space should look like a temple, not a living room. And therefore, you don't need a red carpet on the floor of the sanctuary, as you see in many churches. But the fact is, red is a color that attracts attention. Not only bulls are attracted by red color, even the human eye is. And it is not an appropriate attraction that you should look at the floor in the sanctuary, first of all. Your attention should be drawn upward, not downward. So no more red carpets, I would say, and even no more carpets in the sense of wall-to-wall carpets. Because it shouldn't look like a living room, or worse, a bedroom. Another thing is to cultivate a sense of silence in the church. If the Blessed Sacrament is there in the tabernacle, one's attention should be drawn to that first and foremost. The practice of conversations in church before and after Mass is a distraction from the fact that you're in a sacred space. And so one of the ways of doing that is, in fact, to have an organ prelude that articulates the fact that this is a sacred space. If you come into the church and you hear organ music playing, you say, oh, I'm coming into something that's sacred. As some of you have remarked, one can observe that the louder you play the organ, the louder the conversation becomes. So that one has to charitably include your congregation in the information that this is a sacred place and it demands a certain awesome silence. Likewise, processions. There are a lot of processions called for in the present day liturgy. Big processions on Corpus Christi, on Candlemas, on Palm Sunday, for instance. And those can all be celebrated with festivity and with good music. Likewise, within the Mass itself, the entrance procession. It used to be that the priest would just sneak out from the sacristy and be at the altar, but in fact, an entrance procession which encircles at least part of the church. He goes from the sacristy out a side door, up the side aisle, and down the center aisle, as encircling the congregation. This brings the congregation with him into the sacred space. And this then raises an issue about what music should be done for such a procession. We'll come back to that in just a second. But other processions at the offertory, the asparagus, for instance, can be done. And after Mass on Feasts of the Blessed Virgin, we always make a procession to the altar of the Blessed Virgin, singing the Salve Regina. It's a nice custom as well. And it goes back, in fact, to the Dominican Salve procession after Vespers. My choir sings Vespers every Sunday. And when, many years ago, we had a Marian year, John Paul had declared a Marian year, I puzzled about what could we do to observe the Marian year. And I was working on the Sarum Rite processions, and I realized that they always made a procession to one of the altars, and the return procession was to the main altar, which was dedicated to the Blessed Virgin, singing the Salve Regina, among other things. So I said, why don't we, for the Marian year, make a procession to the Marian image? It was not exactly a whole altar, but there was an image there. It was actually a pretty awful mosaic made by Marin, and it had acquired the halo looked more like feathers than rays of light, and so it acquired the name Our Lady of the War Bond. But the amazing thing happened. As soon as we began to make a procession to that image, those feathers became rays of light again, and this became a true image of the Blessed Virgin, despite its limitations. So we did that for the whole Marian year, and when the Marian year ended, we simply said, we can't stop now, so we still do it. And it's a significant part of the Vespers. It's an incorporation of the body into the liturgy in a way of motion and music all together that are coordinated. For processions such as the Entrite, I think there's a legitimate question to be asked as to who should be singing during the Entrite. If in fact your congregation sings the ordinary, Kyrie, Gloria, Credo, Sanctus, Agnus Dei, they are singing the parts of the Mass that are in and of themselves the liturgical action. The chant for the Entrite is not in and of itself the liturgical action. The action is the procession. And the question is, should the congregation have to provide the accompanying music, or is that not a better function for the choir to provide? And I've been in, I go every year to England, and I go to the Church of England cathedrals to see their liturgy because they do it so well. And I have very often found myself with a program that says, sing hymn number 53 out of the Green Book, set to the tune of hymn number 71 in the Red Book. And so here I've got the program sticking up at the top, and two hymnals open, trying to sing the hymn along like that. And then I say, direct. The procession went by and I didn't even see it. So the point is, the congregation's participation in the procession is to witness the beauty of the procession. The purposeful motion from the west end of the church or around the circle of the church to the most sacred place in the church, incensing the altar as a way of marking it as a sacred place and as a way of initiating the liturgy. And the congregation can be, in fact, moved to tears by a beautiful procession, but they won't be if they're holding the Red Book and the Green Book and trying to figure out how to match those two pieces. So it's really the function of the particular mission of the choir itself to provide that music. So that's why I think our revival of the Mass propers should include the choir singing of those Mass propers. Now, time is running short, so I'll say just a few things about sacred time. You have on your handout a kind of brief diagram of the liturgical year. And I would say that sacred time is one of the most important topics in thinking about the sacred liturgy, because it is based upon nature and creation. We happen to be at exactly the right point to discuss this, because this is the feast of St. John the Baptist. And the entire cycle of Christmas is linked to that feast, among others. As the Cardinal said this morning, immediately after the summer solstice comes St. John the Baptist, at the time when the sun will decrease, and John said, I must decrease and he must increase. Likewise, Christmas then is placed at the winter solstice when the sun begins to increase. The sun is already a symbol of Christ, and so the increase of the sun represents that. Likewise, the Annunciation on the vernal equinox is the 9-month point before Christmas. And even in the Eastern Church and in the Medieval Church, there is a feast of the Annunciation of John the Baptist, somewhere around September 25th. So that there's this seasonal cycle of these Christmas-related feasts. Likewise, then, there is, and of course, that's the sun cycle. There's the moon cycle, which gives us the months, and the moon cycle is the one in which the saints' days are centered, particularly apostles' days. If you look on the old calendar, you'll notice that about one apostles' day occurs every month, around the 25th day of the month. In fact, in the early church, the apostles were associated with the signs, each apostle with a sign of the zodiac, so that there is a sense of the monthly observance of an apostles' day. There is even a Marian cycle. The Nativity of Mary, her conception 9 months before, her presentation 80 days after Nativity, and so forth. So that the end stage of the interaction of the sun cycle and the moon cycle is that no 2 days are quite alike. And that means that it's always something new, something different each day. And this is why I think we should be so concerned about retaining particularly the proper of the Mass. You come to Mass on Sunday and you see that here is a familiar introit that tells you this is this particular Sunday. And so everything has been made new. The hours of the day, the days of the week, the weeks of the month, the months in the year, all of these are differentiated by having different chants associated with them. I can walk into my choir rehearsal and say, Christmas Eve, and two or three people will spontaneously say, Dominus Domine, the introit for the midnight mass on Christmas, so that one acquires an association of these chants with the days of the year, so that each day is unique, is different from the other. And this is so different from picking a hymn from the hymnal 5 minutes before Mass, and probably it's going to be the same one as they sang last week or last month, and you look at the program and it says this is the 75th Sunday in ordinary time. And what does ordinary time have to do with sacred time? You see, this is just a bad translation. It's tempus ordinata, I think, in the Latin, meaning ordered time. But just to express a personal opinion, the reordering of the Sundays after Pentecost and after Epiphany by this system of ordinary time is the work of people who sit in rooms without windows and try to figure out how other people are living. So we do have, I think, a little bit of an overemphasis on the green cycle. I can remember growing up, and the Sundays after Pentecost, about once a month, you'd arrive at church and you'd see the priest was wearing a red or white vestment. And then you'd say, ah, it's a special day today. Isn't that wonderful? We have a relief from the green Sundays. And we hardly get any relief from the green Sundays these days. And perhaps we need a little bit more. So Another little thing about the liturgy and time. The knowledge of the laity about the liturgical year is probably not terribly great even now. And you read Eamon Duffy's The Stripping of the Altars, and you see what kind of preaching was done in the late Middle Ages concerning the liturgical year. He gives you a reference to several manuals of preaching for priests. They give sample sermons of what you should preach on each of these days of the liturgy. They are given more about the lore of the feast and its significance than a modern congregation ever knows. So there was, even in the late Middle Ages, quite an interesting cultivation of a knowledge and an appreciation of the liturgical year and of sacred time. So the applications that we might think of for an increased awareness of sacred time. First and foremost, the revival of the Mass propers. In whatever form you can do it, the first thing you want to make sure is you are using now the cycle of the texts for the Mass. You can sing them to psalm tunes if that's all you can manage. You can sing them to the hymn tune settings of Chris Pizza, but you can also then use some of the briefer English adaptations from the Gradualis Simplex or the more legitimately Gregorian melodies adapted to English, all of which I would say should be steps towards ultimately adopting the Latin chanted propers of the Mass. And I think that that's a campaign that we need to be propagating, and we need to be telling our pastors and our liturgy committees and the rest of the church that the church wants us to sing the Mass, not just sing at Mass, and that means singing the propers of the Mass. Likewise, a cultivation of the celebration of the divine is something that can be done to enhance our sense for of sacred time, among other benefits. Likewise, a revitalization of the seasons of Lent and Advent. For instance, stopping using the organ during the seasons of Advent and Lent. That's a traditional thing, and it's in fact liturgical law, at least for Lent, as I understand it. And then, of course, the choice of all of our music. Motets that we choose can be based upon the sense of the seasons. So those are some thoughts that I have about sacred time and sacred space that will help us, I think, to enhance the sacredness of the liturgy, which is what Pope Pius XII was about when he said that sacred music is sacred, beautiful, and universal.